Welcome to the Decatur Herald and Review. This is Kathy reading to you part one, first page on headlines. How many could have been saved? Providing more funding, staff for Illinois jails to handle inmates' medical needs has been a challenge at the state and federal level. This is a public service journalism report. Between 2021 and 2024, almost 100 individuals died in the custody of municipal or county jail in Illinois, according to data from the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. However, a months-long investigation by the Lee Enterprises Public Service Journalism Team and the Pantograph show that many of these deaths, whether they are the result of withdrawal, chronic medical conditions, or mental health complications, could be prevented. Jail officials have pointed to a lack of both a sustainable funding source for inmate services and a skilled workforce trained to recognize and respond to medical and mental health emergencies. Without these assets, the pressure falls more on community-based resources, which the Illinois legislature has attempted to expand in previous sessions to provide a sufficient level of care for at-risk detainees. Governor J.B. Pritzker said in January that he has attempted to build up mental health care and substance abuse treatment since taking office in 2019. And even if someone is serving time in jail or awaiting a sentencing, it is not right that those individuals be denied access to behavioral health care. The question I think we're asking and that we want to have answered in an appropriate way is, should people who have a substance use problem be serving in jail, or should they be getting care from the appropriate kind of professionals, Pritzker said. One such effort was the Pre-Trial Success Act from Representative Maurice West, Democrat of Chicago, and Senator L.G. Sims, Democrat of Chicago, in 2024 that would appropriate $15 million via the Illinois Department of Human Services grants for community-based pretrial services, including mental health and substance use disorder treatment. Although the bill in its original form failed to make it out of committee, the program was included in last year's budget implementation plan, and $3.5 million was appropriated for a pilot initiative that advocates are hoping to expand statewide during this upcoming budget cycle. I wish it was happening faster, but we're doing the best we can with the available resources we have, Brisker said. But even if those outpatient services were to expand, mental health and substance abuse programs may not accept insurance because insurance doesn't offer a high enough reimbursement rate for services. Many providers just don't take insurance, period, because it doesn't reimburse high enough and the paperwork is too much, said Representative Lindsay LaPointe, Democrat of Chicago. But that is most accurate when we're talking about Medicaid. This year, LaPointe reintroduced legislation seeking to establish more parity between behavioral health and physical health care coverage. This bill would get signed into law on December 12th. Both are behavioral health care providers who do the essential work of keeping our community safe and healthy, as well as the average Illinoisan looking for care, deserve to be heard and seen, LaPointe in a news release said. She also said additional funding streams and special programs are a useful temporary solution, but the focus should be on ensuring that people have access to health care and are connected with a larger network of resources. Whether you touch the criminal justice system or not, we've let our health care systems erode, LaPointe said. Staffing incentives. Without additional funding, nursing and medical staff positions in correctional settings are unable to remain competitive with other private health care opportunities. But according to some jail administrators, incentive programs meant to level the playing field don't always work. Macon County Jail Administrator Jamie Belcher said he's been advised by the jail's health care contractor, Quality Correctional Health Care, that signing bonuses and other incentives offered by the company have been unsuccessful across all seven states where they represent jails. A number of incentive programs are available to recruit medical and behavioral health professionals into underserved regions and facilities, including the National Health Services Corps at the federal level and the Community Behavioral Health Professional Loan Repayment Program at the state level. Although many of these programs are aimed to recruit these individuals to work in Illinois prisons, jails aren't always seen as eligible institutions by these programs. In 2023, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, called for the Health Resources and Services Administration to include Cook County Jail as an eligible site under the National Health Services Corps. He was joined by Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, who wished to make Maricopa County Correctional Health an eligible site. The NHSC offers scholarship opportunities and low repayment options for doctors, nurses, dentists, and behavioral health care providers willing to work in underserved institutions such as prisons and community mental health centers. Given the unique circumstances and challenges associated with providing health care in a correctional facility, county-run jails face significant barriers to recruitment of qualified health professionals, Durbin and Kelly wrote. While federal and state correctional facilities are eligible for the scholarship and loan repayment incentives, staff and loan incentives afforded by the NHSC, a 1989 federal regulation narrowed eligibility to exclude county jails. A funding bill that passed out of the Senate Appropriations Committee last year included language directing HRSA to brief the committee on how to develop a process to provide county correctional facilities the opportunity to participate in the NHSC if they meet program requirements. But as of October, no county jail is eligible as an NHSC site. The state's Community Behavioral Health Professional Loan Repayment Program offers loan repayment assistance to qualified mental health and substance abuse professionals working in community mental health centers. Although the list of eligible workplaces expanded starting in fiscal 2025, Lynn Baker, Managing Director of Communications for the Illinois Student Assistance Commission, said the county jails still are not on the list of facilities that meet the requirements of a community health center under this program. Richard Forbes, Vice President of Program Development for the National Commission on Correctional Health Care, said that even if these incentives were available to county jail employees, there isn't an avenue to provide these benefits to health care employees from outside contractors. The problem with those programs is typically limited to a public employee, or it's a program offered at the state or federal level for offering those incentives, Forbes said. So that's why I don't think you see it as much in the jails, because I would tend to think on my end, you're going to see more county jails using contractors than county employees. Melissa Caldwell, president of Behavioral Health Services for Freedom Behavioral Health, which originally operated under Advanced Correctional Health Care, said her company offers incentives to recruit behavioral health professionals, but cannot apply for federal programs. I've worked in prison systems where the workers were eligible for federal loan repayment, Caldwell said, and unfortunately, private health care providers such as the one I work in are not eligible, and we are explicitly denied eligibility. In response, Caldwell said her organization is exploring the expansion of incentives for county jails, even if private health care contractors are not the direct recipients. CCBHC and Community Resources. In 2023, the Department of Human Services was tasked with submitting a strategic plan to improve access to and overall capacity of state-operated psychiatric hospitals in Illinois. One of the top priorities of this plan was to expand patient options and capacity beyond that of the state's four main mental health centers. In order to accomplish this, DHS would need to simplify the processes required for local providers to take on patients in existing state-operated programs and make it easier for those providers to receive funding for the creation of new services. Some jails offer programs that attempt to restore detainees with severe mental health issues or substance use disorders without intervention from the state. McLean County, in particular, coordinates with the Inmate Services Bureau to provide medication and treatment to individuals unfit to stand trial. This has allowed the McLean County Jail to restore multiple detainees deemed unfit to stand trial to be restored to a level of competency without the need to be transferred to an inpatient facility. Several other detainees found not guilty by reason of insanity were able to be connected to community-based treatment with an inpatient transfer to a state psychiatric facility. But for smaller counties like Woodford, which have no diversion programs or community partnerships to support at-risk detainees, it may be difficult to establish a state-funded framework for mental health care. Most counties are just like us, Tipsworth said. We have no services for them until we start dealing with a mental health issue outside of jail, and this is where everybody's going to end up. Otwell said DHS continues to work with its partners in law enforcement, the courts, mental health advocates, and community providers to identify and implement solutions to this forensic challenge. One possible community-driven avenue is the piloting and establishment of certified community behavioral health clinics. Last year, the McLean County Center for Human Services was one of a handful of facilities across the state to receive a four-year grant from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. The money is meant to help implement substance abuse and mental health services that could help local recipients become certified community behavioral health clinics. With this designation, community-based treatment centers are eligible for an enhanced Medicaid reimbursement rate based on the anticipated cost of these expanded services. Kim Freeman, Chief Clinical Officer for the Center for Human Services, said there are 9 core services a CCBHC must provide, including outpatient mental health and substance abuse services and psychiatric rehab. But if these services were expanded to inmates deemed unfit to stand trial, Freeman said she has a concern that is shared by numerous jail administrators, the inability to force a patient to follow a court-ordered medication or treatment regimen. "We can certainly set someone up with our prescriber and prescribe medications," Freeman said. "But if somebody doesn't come in to take their medications or pick up their medications or they don't take their medications, so there's nothing we can do about that except report that back to the courts." However, CHS works closely with the McLean County Jail to complete a screening for detainees in need of mental health services once they're released, whether it be psychiatry, case management, or counseling services. Also, if there's ever an issue with a crisis going on in the jail or with one of the inmates, then they're able to notify our crisis team or mobile crisis team, Freeman said, and then they're able to provide those services to them as needed. But as a certified clinic, Freeman said CHS will be able to expand substance abuse services and address behavioral health care as a whole. Freeman added that she hopes to use a portion of the funding to hire an internship coordinator who can collaborate with local universities to provide intern opportunities at CHS that could grow into full-time employment. Illinois is one of 10 states participating in the CCBHC Medicaid Demonstration Program. As a part of this, the state has provisionally certified 19 locations that were determined to be ready to implement all state and federal CCBHC requirements. Included in this list is Chestnut Health Systems, which is seeking state and federal certification at its facilities in Madison and St. Clair counties. This headline reads, "Funding Crisis for Medicaid Looms. Changes at Federal Level Slash Funding Tool that is used by the state," by Peter Hancock. A multi-billion-dollar budget crisis will hit the state's Medicaid program in the next few years unless state lawmakers and Governor J.B. Pritzker act to prevent it, budget analysts both inside and outside state government warn. The crisis comes from changes in federal Medicaid policy that were enacted last year as part of Donald Trump's sweeping domestic policy agenda, known officially as H.R. 1, or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which among many other things slashes one of the main funding tools many states have used for 4 decades to fund their share cost of Medicaid. By the time you're a few years in, you're looking at a $5, $4, $5, $6 billion a year hit. And that's material, Paula Worthington, a researcher with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, said during a recent interview. Worthington is a co-author of a recent IGPA report that describes the upcoming changes in Medicaid funding as one of the most serious long-term fiscal challenges facing Illinois. The funding tools at issue are known as provider taxes. Those are special taxes that states levy on hospitals, nursing homes, private insurance plans, known as managed care organizations or MCOs, and other kinds of health care providers. States levy those taxes, usually on a per patient or per bed basis, and put the money into a fund that is used to draw down federal matching funds. The combination of state and federal funds is then used either to enhance Medicaid reimbursement rates or make direct payments to hospitals and nursing homes that serve large numbers of Medicaid patients to help sustain those facilities financially. Capping provider taxes. When Medicaid was first established in 1965, it was a relatively modest program that provided health care benefits to people who already qualified for other kinds of public assistance, with costs split between the federal government and the states. As both the size and cost of the program grew, however, states began looking for new ways to pay for their share of the cost outside their general revenues. Provider taxes emerged in the mid-1980s as one such mechanism. By the mid-1990s, Congress began putting controls on state-levied provider taxes. Those included rules that they be broad-based and uniform, meaning they had to apply evenly across an entire class of healthcare providers and not just those that served Medicaid patients. The idea was that states were prohibited from holding providers harmless by assuring them that they would get all their money back and then some once the federal matching funds were drawn down. But the federal rules also included a safe harbor provision. States could avoid having to comply with the hold harmless prohibition as long as their taxes amounted to no more than 6% of net patient revenue. That rule has effectively served as a cap on what states can levy in the form of a provider tax, but that cap is about to be cut nearly in half. Under the provision of H.R. 1, a provision that only applies to states like Illinois that expanded Medicaid eligibility under the Affordable Care Act, that 6% cap will gradually be cut starting in FY 2028 until it reaches 3.5% in fiscal year 2032. In FY 2025, according to the Department of Health Care and Family Services, Illinois spent a total of $33.7 billion through its Medicaid program, making it one of the single largest categories of expenditures in state government. Of that total, $20.9 billion, or 62%, was federal money, while the remaining $12.8 billion came from state funds, including both general revenue and provider taxes. IGPA reported that provider taxes in FY 2025 amounted to $4.7 billion, or about 37% of all the state funds that were spent on Medicaid. The bulk of that money, according to DHFS, came from two provider taxes, those on hospitals and MCOs. A recent report by the nonpartisan health policy research organization KFF points out that Illinois stands to lose more than any other state when the reductions take effect because it is the only state whose hospital and MCO assessments are both above the 3.5% threshold. The report by IGPA estimates that when the first reduction takes effect in FY 2028, revenues from those two assessments alone will fall $239 million. And depending on how much healthcare prices and Medicaid usage grows over the next 5 years, total reductions from those two sources could range from $1.25 billion to $2 billion in FY 2033. But remember, that's just the state money, Worthington said. That's not taking into account the matching funds. Assuming the state continues to receive an average 62% federal match rate, the total impact to Illinois by FY 2033 would be between $3.3 and $5.3 billion a year. The estimate aligns with a separate estimate from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, which reported in October that if the state does not make up for the reduced provider taxes through some other appropriation, the gross amount of lost funding to the state and its Medicaid program will total over $4.5 billion annually by fiscal year 2031 when factoring the lost federal match. The impending limits on Medicaid provider taxes will pose a significant challenge for lawmakers, who will either have to find some other way to pay the state's share of the cost or adjust the program to fit within the new fiscal constraints. But because the federal changes do not take effect for another year, it is possible that lawmakers will not feel pressure to take immediate action in the upcoming legislative session. Capital News Illinois, who reported this, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. The next headline is Trump ties stance on Greenland to Nobel snub. Norway Prime Minister gets the telling text from the president by Amir Mandani, Geir Molson, and Jill Lawless. U.S. President Donald Trump linked his aggressive stance on Greenland to last year's decision not to award him the Nobel Peace Prize, telling Norway's prime minister he no longer felt an obligation to think purely of peace in a text message released on Monday. Trump's message to Jonas Gahr Støre appears to ratchet up a standoff between Washington and its close allies over the threats to take over Greenland, a self-governing territory of NATO member Denmark. On Saturday, Trump announced a 10% import tax starting in February on goods from eight nations that have rallied around Denmark and Greenland, including Norway. These countries issued a forceful rebuke. Many longtime allies of the U.S. remain resolute that Greenland was not for sale, but encouraged Washington to discuss solutions. In a statement on social media, the European Union's foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas said the bloc had no interest to pick a fight, but would hold our ground. The White House has not ruled out taking control of the strategic Arctic island by force. Asked whether Trump could invade Greenland, Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen said on Monday, "You can't leave anything out until the president himself has decided to leave anything out." British Prime Minister Keir Starmer also sought to de-escalate tensions on Monday. "I think this can be resolved and should be resolved through calm discussion," he added, saying that he did not believe military action would occur. In a sign of how tensions have increased in recent days, thousands of Greenlanders marched over the weekend in protest of any effort to take over their island. Greenland Prime Minister Jan Frederik Nielsen said on a Facebook post Monday that the tariff threats would not change their stance. "We will not be pressured," he wrote. Meanwhile, Nadja Nathanielsen, Greenland's Minister for Business, Minerals, Energy, Justice, and Equality, told the Associated Press that she was moved by the quick response of allies to the tariff threat and said that it showed that countries realize this is about more than Greenland. "I think a lot of countries are afraid that if they let Greenland go, what would be next?" Trump's Sunday message to Gahr Støre, released by the Norwegian government, read in part, "Considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8 wars, plus I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace, although it will always be predominant, but can now think of what is good and proper for the United States of America." It included, "The world is not secure unless we have complete and total control of Greenland." The Norwegian letter said Trump's message was a reply to an earlier missive sent on behalf of himself and Finnish President Alexander Stubb, in which they conveyed their opposition to the tariff announcement, pointed a need to de-escalate, and proposed a telephone conversation among the three leaders. Norway's position on Greenland is clear. Greenland is a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, and Norway fully supports the Kingdom of Denmark on this matter, the Norwegian letter said in a statement. "As regards the Nobel Peace Prize, I have clearly explained, including to President Trump what is well known, the prize is awarded by an independent Nobel Committee and not the Norwegian government." The Norwegian Nobel Committee is an independent body whose 5 members are appointed by the Norwegian Parliament. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent defended the president's approach in Greenland during a brief Q&A with reporters in Davos, Switzerland, which is hosting the World Economic Forum meeting this week. "I think it's a complete canard that the president would be doing this because of the Nobel," Bessent said, immediately after saying he did not know anything about the president's letter to Norway. Bessent insisted Trump is looking at Greenland as a strategic asset for the United States, adding, "We are not going to outsource our hemispheric security to anyone else." Trump has openly coveted the Peace Prize, which the committee awarded to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado last year. Last week, Machado presented her Nobel Medal to Trump, who said he planned to keep it, although the committee said the prize can't be revoked, transferred, or shared with others. Trump says he will use tariffs as a bargaining chip. In his latest threat of tariffs, Trump indicated there would be retaliation for last week's deployment of symbolic numbers of troops from the European countries to Greenland, though he also suggested that he was using the tariffs as leverage to negotiate with Denmark. European governments said that the troops traveled to the island to assess Arctic security, part of a response to Trump's own concerns about interference from Russia and China. 6 of the 8 countries targeted are part of the 27-member European Union, which operates as a single economic zone in terms of trade. European Council President Antonio Costa said Sunday that the bloc's leaders expressed readiness to defend ourselves against any form of coercion. He announced a summit for Thursday evening. And on page 2, second high-value scam hits the suburbs. Palos Hills resident loses $788,000 in phone scheme, by Evie Lewis. An elderly Palos Hills resident lost $788,000 in a phone scam that's under investigation, according to the Palos Hills Police Department. Police said the victim was targeted over the course of several phone calls by an unknown suspect or suspects. There were multiple scams organizing utilizing Bitcoin, the sending of cashier's checks, and the purchase of gold, a December 29th news release said. Palos Hills police declined to comment on the ongoing investigation. On the same day, another phone scam was reported in Palos Hills, where a victim was contacted by someone claiming to be a representative of Chase Bank, police said. That victim lost $19,000 when the supposed bank representative told them they needed to send money to verify they weren't involved in a fraud. Such fraud scams are common in the area. The Daily Southtown reported in November that a new Lenox man lost $235,000 in an online scam involving fraudulent cryptocurrency investments. The victim in that case had transferred funds from his cryptocurrency wallet to a website where he was told to make an account by a person who contacted him over text. Once the funds were transferred, he was locked out of the account. Scams targeting elderly people for large amounts of money are on the rise nationally, according to a report by the Federal Trade Commission. In particular, older victims are more likely to lose money in amounts exceeding $100,000 from scams, as scammers target retirees' life savings. From 2020 to 24, the number of reports from older adults who lost $10,000 or more to these scams increased more than fourfold, the report said. When older adults report losing more than $100,000, the trend was even more striking. During the same period, the number of reports increased nearly sevenfold, and the combined losses reported went up eightfold. Older adults' vigilance about protecting their savings can be the very thing that makes them vulnerable to scams, the report said, because scammers frequently use security alerts and other false alarms to create a sense of urgency around a problem that the victim can fix by sending money. Palos Park, which neighbors Palos Hills, has been proactive in attempting to warn residents, particularly seniors, about the risks of scams and how to recognize them. The median age in Palos Park is 58, according to the 2020 census. Palos Park Police Chief Joe Miller was the target of an arrest warrant scam in 2021, where a caller claims to have a warrant out for the victim's arrest. The Federal Trade Commission advised people to never move money in response to an unexpected text or phone call, and to hang up and call back to a verified number if contacted by someone claiming to be from a bank or a government agency. Resign, replace scheme repeats. The Illinois Supreme Court makes it a common practice. Remember the national uproar last November when U.S. Representative Chuy Garcia bowed out of his re-election race at the last minute and quietly passed petitions to put his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, on the ballot? We saw a lesser but quite palpable mass grumbling when State Representative Marty Moland, Democrat of Des Plaines, did the same that month for his chief of staff, Justin Cochran, who was subsequently appointed to the House by the district's Democratic Township Committee persons after Moylan resigned. But you didn't hear any disapproval last week when Illinois Supreme Court Justice Mary Jane Theis simultaneously announced her retirement and the appointment of Appellate Court Justice Sanjay Taylor to fill her seat until the 2028 election. This sort of resign and replacement move is far more common at the Illinois Supreme Court than in any other body of government. During the 21st century, six Illinois Supreme Court justices have won open seat elections, but eight justices were appointed to fill out terms of retired justice before an election, including Justice Taylor, according to research by my associate Isabel Villner and me, and this was written by Rich Miller. Justice Theis herself was appointed to replace retiring Chief Justice Thomas Fitzgerald in 2010 and then ran as an appointed incumbent in the 2012 campaign cycle. As with her predecessor, Fitzgerald, Justice Theis had to finish serving a term as Chief Justice before she decided to step down. She could have quit before the candidate filing period began last fall, but she waited until long after the ballot was set before making her decision. Now, I happen to think very highly of Justice Theis. I don't agree with her all the time, but that's not the requirement. She's been a solid jurist and won a Capital Facts Golden Horseshoe Award last month. Her hand-picked replacement seems robustly qualified to serve. But this constant resign and replacement scheme by the state's top court is really getting old. The tradition of the top court is to allow retiring justices to select their replacements. The rest of the justices then go along as a courtesy. To their credit, no real duds have ever been appointed, and since justices live and dine together in a dormitory-like setting during their Springfield sessions, I can understand why they would want to screen their roomies. Still, it's not like the people who won open seat races were creeps. Far from it. Justices Tom Fitzgerald and Tom Kilbride won both open seats in 2000. Justice Lloyd Carmeier won an open seat in 2024, and Justice David Overstreet won a similar battle in 2020. Justices Mary Kay O'Brien and Elizabeth Rochford won hotly contested open seat races in 2022. Justice Bob Thomas defeated appointed Justice Louis Rajdi in the 2000 Republican primary. And that's all we have time for today. That will be it for part one. I'll be back shortly with part two of the Decatur Herald and Review.